Describe this experimental situation where there's a source emitting entangled particles. Well, for the moment, we'll just describe it classically. So let's actually remove this. We just want to build a general, what we want to build is a realist model to describe, to give a causal story. For the observable correlations. Okay, so we're gonna construct such a model. The quantity we want to explain is this quantity S, which is defined as these correlations. Under this causal story. So now what we're going to prove is that under this assumption, under reasonable assumptions, which we'll be very explicit about, we want to prove that S is greater than, is in the range minus 2 to 2. So we imagine we have a space lambda, which is the space of, or set of values of the relevant physical quantities. Okay, so then we have lambda, which is an element of lambda, is the value of the physical quantities in any given run. Or values of the physical quantities. In a given run. And then we're going to have rho of lambda is the distribution over runs. So we allow these quantities to vary from run to run. They can be statistically distributed. And rho is our probability density. Which allows for, doesn't require, but it allows for statistical variation. Of the lambda values from lambda over each run. Okay, so you can think of lambda could just be defined to be the wave function itself, or lambda could be equal to the position and the momenta of the relevant particles. Or it can be both, or lambda could be the position, the momentum, and the wave function. It can be anything, okay? So we make no assumptions about what lambda is. So examples. So if you think the wave function is a real object, then you would think lambda is that. If you think the wave function is part of reality, then you would maybe posit this. We're making no assumption about what reality is, just that there is some reality. That's all. So the physical reality is encoded by this. So the things that are real. So just like you think about, you say, look, I have a pointer, I have a dial on the apparatus, and I can turn that dial and set it to something, then that has some physical value. We assume that the dial exists independently of us, and we can set the dial that has some definite property. It's not just a figment of our imagination. Okay, so this has some physical value. Call it sigma, is the physical value, is the variable assigned assigned to the real object, the real slash objective position of the dial. So here, if it's a dial, sigma would be maybe here, so lambda for the dial would just be equal to some angle, which is this, you know, the angle of the dial. Okay, but now we're talking about lambda of the system is the information that comes out of the source. So remember, something invisible comes out of the source, and now we're saying lambda describes the physical properties of that. It's the thing, the physical properties that propagate from the source to the measurement apparatus. That's what lambda is. So it can be anything you want. And then we assume that S then is going to be constructed from integrating over all possible values of lambda, where in any given run, S is assigning these outcomes. So in particular, S of lambda would be equal to a sum over all four possible, summing over all four input settings of the apparatus, which gives us our four different measurements. Which depends on lambda. And then we put a minus one to the I times J. So minus one, if I and J are both one, that gives us this minus sign here. So we're just coming up with a compact notation for what this is. And these observed quantities are going to depend on what the reality was that caused that observed quantity. And then what that looks like is that this quantity corresponds to, experimentally, it corresponds to the expectation over the outputs xy conditioned on the settings, and then we assume that it's the underlying physical properties of the system that propagated. The system that propagated from the source to the detectors had some properties which can be arbitrarily correlated, and these properties then are going to determine the out, probabilistically determine the outputs. So we get a sum over xy. XY, and then some probability distribution of XY, AI, DJ, lambda. So notice that we can also replace this with an integral. So if x and y, which are the outputs, if they're in this continuous range, minus 1 to 1, then we would use the integral. If x and y are discrete, as we see quantum mechanically, when you measure a spin half, you either get plus h bar over 2 or minus h bar over 2. There's only two outcomes. So that's the special case where we would have just two outcomes labeled by minus one and plus one. So the theorem doesn't care if you, so in quantum mechanics, these outcomes are discrete. More generally, we can imagine a continuous set of outcomes. The proof I'm about to show you doesn't care which of these cases is the case. So it's a matter of taste if you want to treat this as a sum or an integral, depending on if you want to consider a more general scenario where you have continuous outcomes, which is what you would expect classically. And then what we have happening here is that we're saying, look, we're looking at the correlation in the output. So X and Y are the outputs from Alice and Bob. Remember, those are the answers to the questions in the CHSH game. And so we're looking at how correlated they are. And because we want them to be anti-correlated when I equals 1 and J equals 1, that's accounted for here. So we want, the goal is to have them anti-correlated in one case. And then our score S takes that into account by this minus one here, which makes the negative correlation here give a positive outcome, give a positive improvement to S. And then what we're allowing here is we're saying, look, the probability of Alice reporting outcome X and Bob reporting outcome Y depends on the measurement that Alice is doing, her choice of dial setting, Bob's choice of dial setting, and the information from the source. This is lambda system. Okay, so here lambda is equal to lambda system. All right, so the dial setting, remember I said we can talk about the reality of the dial setting. We assume the dial setting is real, and so we assign some lambda dial to it. That's actually just this 0 or this 1. So is the dial set to position 0 or is the dial set to position 1? Okay, you can think of this as being lambda dial. And we'll call lambda is just lambda system. So this is the shared information at the source. Remember in the game, CHSH game, I said Alice and Bob could have some initial script. They could have some plan, some shared plan, which they bring into the booths with them. That's this information lambda. That's their prearranged plan. But now to make the game work, how did we stop them from winning 100% of the time? Well, before I get to that, let me say one more thing about this. This probability distribution could be a Dirac measure. It could be a point measure. In other words, it could be that the outcome X is fully determined by A, B, and lambda. So that's consistent with this, but we're doing something more general. In fact, this is the innovation of CHSH over Bell's theorem. So originally when Bell derived this theorem, he assumed that X and Y were determined from the dial settings and these hidden variables lambda, these properties lambda. So in other words, there was no extra randomness that was allowed in his proof. But then CHSH realized that, well, actually, you can allow randomness. You can allow the outcomes X and Y to depend. You can drop the assumption of determinism and have a weaker set of assumptions, which makes the theorem stronger, which says, well, no, we'll even allow there to be randomness that determines X and Y. It doesn't have to be deterministic. So this is a non-deterministic model, which is more general. Okay, so if you prefer to think about this as being X and Y are fully fixed, that's a special case of this, where this probability distribution is just a Dirac, a Kronecker delta function or a Dirac measure, okay? Dirac delta function. So that's a special case. So we have this general probabilistic relationship. Now, what did we assume when we assumed that Alice and Bob couldn't win 100% of the time? What constraint did we impose in the CHSH game? Exactly. Remember, we impose a no communication between A and B. In fact, we can impose further, we allow no causal mechanism. between A and B other than lambda itself. So of course, they have this source information, lambda. So we're allowing them to have some prepared script. We're allowing them to have shared information, but we're not allowing communication between A and B. Specifically, why? Because we don't want Bob to know what question Alice was asked. So we don't want Bob to know what input Alice was given, which of course he knows the map. His prior information means he knows the map from 01 to A0, A1. So we don't want him to know 01 because we don't want him to know A0, A1. We also don't want Bob to know what the output was. So we don't want Bob to know either the input or the output. We only allow Bob to know lambda, which is the information that the source provided, and any other information in there. You can think of the source as the plan they had before they went into the booths. Okay? So other than lambda itself, which is their shared information, okay, so what we're going to try and show is how much correlation can there be when the only shared information they have is their pre-shared information lambda from the source. And when we talk about no communication here, what we're saying is that we disallow Bob's output or input to depend on Alice's, this is system B, system A, output or input. So this is an and. We don't allow Bob's output and input to depend on Alice's output or input, and vice versa. Okay, so how do we encode that mathematically? That means that we say that the probability of X and Y, which we allowed to depend on A, B, and lambda, factorizes. So we're saying, no, it's the case, the probability of X can only depend on A and lambda, and the probability of Y can only depend on B and lambda. So this is called the local causality assumption. And this, generally speaking, is assumed to be the assumption that fails because quantum mechanics violates that inequality. That inequality depends on this assumption, and it's viewed as everything else is, or the other assumption you can reject is this assumption, that there is some real objective properties that can be assigned to whatever it is that's coming out of the source. Okay, now, let me just say, and so we already made a realist assumption. That lambda is a reason, is a property. Is a physical property. That the system has physical properties. We can assign a lambda. Okay, whether that lambda is the state itself or anything, we're saying we assume that the system has physical properties and we can assign some lambda. Notice that we're fine with doing that for the dial setting. We're okay with assigning that a property. But people are uncomfortable assigning quantum system properties because Bohr told them not to. All right, Bohr said, look, we're allowed to talk about dial settings and pointer positions, which are the properties of the classical apparatus that we directly observe. But we're not allowed to talk about properties of the quantum system that we're observing. So I find that awkward. I mean, I know I told you the story. I was visiting Reiner Blatt this summer. I saw the atom he had trapped in his ion trap, which was a Paul trap. And it was a single atom trapped in electromagnetic fields. And they were shining a laser on it. And you could directly see it looked like a star in the sky. So I'm pretty comfortable saying that there was some property there that caused the light to bounce off of. There was something physical was there for sure. So I'm comfortable assigning physical properties to atoms. And this is and electrons and photons, but some people aren't. Anyhow, so we make this assumption, which is a very philosophical assumption, and we make this assumption, which is a very physical assumption. And these two assumptions, we made this earlier by assuming we could even have a talk about a lambda at all, and we make this now by this factorization condition. Okay, so basically we've made these two assumptions. So now the rest is just math. So now we say for every element, for each of these empirical quantities, we have the sum over the values of x, y. I'll just use the sum version. Think of this as an integral if you prefer. X times y, which is the correlation. And now we insert the factorization assumption. So we're saying the probability of x only depends on ai and lambda, and the probability of y only depends on bj and lambda. So here we make the local causality. And what that means is that this is actually equal to, notice that now the whole thing can be expressed as an expectation, as sum over x, probability of x, conditioned on the source information and the input question, times the sum over y, probability of y on the dial setting. Bob's question and the associated dial setting are allowed to come in here. But notice that the probability of x doesn't depend on b, and the probability of y doesn't depend on a. The probability of y doesn't depend on the output x either. So we've already assumed when we don't allow y to depend on x, we don't allow x to depend on y, we're saying that their outcomes can't depend on the outcomes obtained by the other party. Yes?
For the when you defined it over there, you had the integral over d lambda. Should that not be there?
We're getting there. We're getting there. So let me make sure I don't have a typo. So at some point we integrate over lambda and we define these quantities, these lambda dependent quantities.
Okay.
Here. And then so I think what I want to do is have a lambda here. And then we integrate over lambda later. So this is in a given run. So every time I press the go button on the source, there's some value of lambda that comes out. And now I want to say, what's the probability that I got outcome X and Y from Alice and Bob in that one given run?
That's just for a given run.
Yeah. And then we're going to collect aggregate statistics over runs. So averaging over lambda is like averaging over runs. So quantum mechanics only makes predictions in the aggregate over the ensemble. And so we're going to replicate that by averaging over the lambda values, which you can imagine lambda is just fixed if you wished. But so the key point here is now this is just the definition. We'll just define this to be AI lambda, and we'll define this to be B sub J lambda. Okay, so this is obviously a definition. So that means that in general then, for our S, which depends on lambda, we are going to have A0 lambda, B0 lambda, plus A0 lambda times B1 lambda. And this is just linearity, plus A1 lambda times B0 lambda minus A1 lambda B1 lambda. Now we just remark the mathematical fact that we can normalize, maybe we already have. All right, we required that X was no bigger than 1 and no less than, that X is in the range. So X is less than or equal to 1, and Y is less than or equal to 1. That was part of our model, where we assume we just get, you could just renormalize to fit these things in some range, assuming you don't have infinitely large eigenvalues. Okay, so then we can write, so that means, of course, that each of the AIs is in the interval minus 1 plus 1, as well as each of the B sub J's, because each of these guys, so this variable ranges between minus 1 and 1, and we're just multiplying it by a probability. Okay, so this means that we can express S lambda as, what we do is we pull out the eight. Right, if I switch to lowercase a, it's because my notes have a lowercase a, so please alert me to that. We pull out a zero and multiply it by b zero plus b one. And these are all lambda dependent quantities. And we do the same for a one. And we multiply it by B0 minus B1. But that means that S then, the maximum value A0 can take on is plus 1. This guy. So that means this whole expression has to be, this is the most, the biggest this can be is 1 times this and 1 times that. So that means that the biggest value we can possibly have is the absolute value of B0 lambda plus B1 lambda plus the absolute value of the difference between B0 lambda and B1 lambda. Okay, so that's just a property of variables. Think of these as just variables between minus 1 and 1, and we're adding and subtracting them. So clearly this quantity is up, this sum of them is upper bounded by these two absolute values. Now without loss of generality, let's just choose one to be larger. And let's just call that one B0. So we'll say without loss of generality, we'll just define B0 lambda to be bigger than B1 lambda. And that implies that S lambda is upper bounded by twice the size of B0 lambda. But B zero lambda itself is within the range 1 minus 1. So that means that S lambda must be less than or equal to 2. Okay, it's just a simple geometric fact about random variables. Nothing mysterious there. So then, similarly, we can show that S lambda has to be greater than minus 2. So then it follows that S lambda has to range between 2 and minus 2. And then S, which is equal to the integral over d lambda, rho lambda, S lambda, has to also be bound by the probabilistic average of its individual cases. So that means that S itself, which is the average over runs. So we've just proven the CHSH theorem. Any questions about the mathematical proof and or the underpinnings, conceptual underpinnings here? Our next step is to show that we can quantum mechanically get S equal to 2 times root 2, which is greater than 2. So quantum mechanics violates this inequality, and the question is why? Which of our assumptions were false? So this bound follows from, well, let's make it 3 assumptions. The zeroth assumption, so here are our assumptions. Assumption 0 is that math works. Assumption 1 is that we have, we can talk about atoms having properties independently of their observation. And assumption 2 is locality, or local causality. And notice that when we call it local causality, it automatically brings to mind notions of special relativity and all that, right? But in a sense, that's kind of misleading, because really the assumption is there's just no causal mechanism. No causal mechanism. So if Alice and Bob are playing that CHSH game and they're in two different electromagnetically shielded booths across the room, and then all of a sudden they're winning 85% of the time, you would think they were cheating. And so then what you would do is you would take those booths and you would make them space-like separated. And you'd ask them the questions in a space-like separated way where they have to answer with, suppose that it takes the speed of light, it takes, say, you separate them far enough apart that the speed of light is, say, 3 seconds to get from Alice to Bob. So then what you do is you ask Alice her question and you ask her to answer in less than 3 seconds, and Bob has to answer in less than 3 seconds. And what that means is you know for sure that they couldn't possibly have communicated, that there's no failure of your electromagnetic shielding, because they had to answer faster than the speed of light. And if you reject any outcomes where they don't answer that quickly. So you only keep the outcomes where they answer within 3 seconds, and then you're guaranteed there was no communication. So the local causality assumption, which brings in relativity, is really just a way to enforce this idea that we're imposing, that there's no mode of causal, no possible causal explanation for their correlations. So the quantum mechanical prediction, we take H to be C2 tensor C2, so either two photons, where it could be their polarization. This is the way experiments are usually done. Or you can imagine it's two spin half particles. Or you could imagine it's the ground state and excited states of two atoms. And then we use the fact that we define the measurement AL, we realize it as the operator sigma dot the vector AL. Okay, where sigma is an operator valued, it's just the Pauli operator. So it's x, y, z, where this is the usual Pauli x, the usual Pauli y, and the usual Pauli z. And you can think of these as the spin component sx, xy, and sz, but with the h bar over 2 removed for just simplifying notation. So we define that's the setting AL means exactly measuring my spin. What this means is I'm doing a Stern-Gerlach measurement of spin along the Euclidean spatial direction A. So A is just a direction in space. This is a direction in Euclidean space. And I just mean R3 here, okay? So, should I call it physical space? I don't know, whatever, we'll just call it Euclidean space. And then similarly, we define, I think I called this AI, so obviously I and L are dummy indices. So here, L is an element of 0, 1. I called it I a moment ago, but now I'm gonna call, instead of J, I'll call it K. The dial setting BK is associated with measuring the Stern-Gerlach measurement of spin along spatial direction BK. Okay, so this is some spatial direction. So I'm measuring, Alice is measuring her spin half particle in one direction in space, and Bob is choosing another direction. And Bob has a pre-assigned plan that he has two different directions he's going to choose from. And what direction he chooses depends on the question he was asked. So the game show host says, okay, in this run, I want you to, the question I'm asking you is 0. Please provide an answer 1 or 0 to that question. So then Bob now, instead of just making up an answer, says, okay, I'm going to, on my first quantum system in my ordered set on my device, I'm going to measure its spin direction along the direction BK, the spatial direction BK. And he does that measurement. The quantum mechanical gives him a plus or minus h bar over 2 outcome, where plus h bar over 2 is plus 1, and minus h bar over 2 is minus 1. And so then he provides as output the outcome of his measurement. So Bob's output is given by measuring the, let's call this BK operator, and we'll call this operator AL. So B is going to have, BK has a spectral decomposition, plus 1, let's see, plus BK Let's not do that. It's a spectral decomposition, which is some the plus BK output plus the minus BK output. So Bob does that projective measurement. And this gives, he's going to get either outcome plus one or outcome minus one. Okay, and then the probability that Bob gets the plus BK outcome is, of course, just given by the Born rule. So trace of plus BK, or the plus is supposed to go inside, times rho. But now, and so, and similarly for Alice. Okay, so Alice follows the same procedure. Okay, and then the input state. The input state for both systems is going to be rho equals psi minus, where psi minus is an entangled state of the form spin down, spin up, minus spin up, spin down over square root of 2, which we can write as minus 1 plus 1 minus plus 1 minus 1 over square root of 2. Okay, or we can write it in the other notation, which is 0, 1, minus 1, 0 over square root of 2. And again, this is, in any of these cases, an object of the form up, down is equal to, I mean, sorry, down, up. So this is Alice and this is Bob. So this is Alice, Bob in each case. So this is an entangled state. And it's called a Bell state now because of its significance for Bell's theorem. So it's also no, it's also the singlet state, if you remember your singlet triplet for two spin half particles. It's the singlet state of two spin half particles. And this is a also called a Bell state. And it is maximally entangled. It is maximally entangled because we can calculate the trace of rho A is going to be equal to, the trace of rho A squared is going to be equal to, well, let's call the entropy. The entropy of rho A is going to be equal to, rho A is equal to identity over 2. And so the entropy of rho A, and this is obtained by taking the trace over B of the singlet state. And the entropy is going to be the maximum, which is what? It's log D. So it's going to be log 2. But now we're not interested in Bob. Remember, Bob and Alice are both doing their measurements on the same system. So it's not the case that just Bob is doing a measurement or just Alice is doing a measurement. The joint measurement is expressed in the form sigma A tensor sigma B. So then we can calculate the the experimental quantity, the experimental quantity is the limit as the number of runs goes to infinity of the average of the outcomes. And this is exactly going to be the experimental quantity is this, and that's equal to the theoretical prediction from quantum mechanics, which is the trace of rho of sigma AL tensor sigma BK. And I think I've changed my notation here. So I called the observable here, I called it BK, which now I'm also calling it sigma BK over here. And similarly for sigma A. Okay, so it just refers to this observable. So this is the quantity, and we can denote it with whatever symbol we want. Right? That's the quantity of interest. And similarly for Alice, this is the quantity of interest. But they're both measuring their systems, and so we have a tensor product. Alice does her measurement on her system. Bob does his measurement on his system. We can predict the correlation of their outcomes by calculating it quantum mechanically or by measuring it experimentally. And if you measure it experimentally and you don't have an input state that it's an entangled state, you're going to be bound by Bell's theorem. If your input state is the wave function or quantum mechanical wave function, then you will get something that's not bound by Bell's theorem. So then what you can show is you can just directly compute, and I'll leave this as an exercise. You use some algebraic identities and you show that the trace of psi minus sigma A K tensor sigma B L is actually equal to the vector product, the dot product. I call it, is A, oh, A is L and B is K, sorry. A, L, B, K. A, L, B, K. So the quantum mechanical prediction is minus the inner product of the directions Alice and Bob chose for their measurement. And those directions were fixed by the input questions 0 and 1. 0 or 1 here, 0 or 1 here. So there's four possible measurements. The four cases of zero, four values of the pairs of zero and one of the two bits. And then the optimal choice of directions, optimal choice of AL and BK for every value for every L and K. So we have, Alice has two choices and Bob has two choices, and the optimal set of choices gives S equals 2 root 2. And geometrically what this corresponds to is that we pick an XY, we pick a plane in real space. So we imagine that, you know, if the particle's coming to Bob this way, he defines a plane that's orthogonal to the direction of the particle arriving, and he measures the, so imagine that the particle is propagating along Z, and then he does a Stern-Gerlach measurement in the XY plane. And then what Bob does is he chooses B0 to be pointing, to be the vector pointing up, and he chooses B1 along Y, to be the vector pointing up along x. And Alice and Bob share a reference frame for this problem. They can use the stars or whatever. And then Alice chooses her measurement direction, A0, to be at a 45-degree angle relative to Bob's. So that's the plan. So if someone provides you with this device that has ordered sets of entangled pairs that you share with your friend, and then you ever play this game show, you tune your measurement directions in this way, and you will be able to win the game show 85% of the time. And we have no causal explanation of how that's possible. That's the mystery of non-locality in quantum mechanics. So obviously this is a very compelling story. So it's been tested experimentally under increasingly rigorous conditions. We're considered to be the first kind of the first decisive experiment where really people felt like it was an illustration that satisfied the local causality assumption in a reasonable way was the first kind of widely accepted experimental proof. So notice the quantum mechanics predicts this. So you can think, well, maybe quantum mechanics is wrong. Maybe the world does satisfy local realism. And experimentally, we always are bound by two. And quantum mechanics just makes the wrong prediction. So the first widely accepted experimental verification which you can also think of as a validation of the quantum prediction was performed by Alain Aspect's group in a series of experiments in the very early 1980s. Oh, sorry, it's 81, 82. And then people increasingly have improved the, people want to rule out various loopholes. You imagine there's a lot of kind of conspiracy theories about how the experiments didn't quite satisfy the local causality assumption. Because remember earlier I said, we make this constraint that Alice and Bob have to answer within 3 seconds, where we assume that it takes light to propagate 3 seconds from the time Alice knew her question to the time Bob had to answer based on knowing his question. So Alice and Bob have to be asked the question simultaneously, and they have to answer. To guarantee the shielding, you use special relativity. You say, well, there's no way they could have communicated because they responded in a sufficiently short time. But of course, 3 seconds is very long. Light can go from here to like halfway to the sun. So what they actually do is they actually randomly set the detector measurement settings using a local source of randomness. And Alice and Bob aren't people. It's actually quantum detectors. And the quantum detectors reported their output in less than the space-like the time it would take light to travel, whatever that would have been, some tens of nanoseconds. They actually designed an apparatus to do this just to prove there was no way that this apparatus could have causally depended on the local source of randomness. But now you say, well, what do you mean local source of randomness? There really isn't any randomness because classically everything is determined, and so maybe there's some fluctuation. What do I use for my random source? Well, it's some fancy way of just rolling dice locally, and of course the outcome of dice rolls are determined. They just appear random to us because we don't know the details of all the air molecules that caused the outcome of the die roll. So what they actually did is they did, and I think this was done in the 90s by Gregor Weiss, they redid the experiments where they had another photon come in, which was in a superposition of two polarization states, and they measured that photon and got one of two random outcomes from the quantum test, and then used the outcome, and this is fancy electronics, they used the outcome of that measurement to determine the random detector setting for the photon from the Bell pair. And that way they, you know, claimed their randomness was as true as quantum randomness is true. So if you believe quantum randomness is true, then their randomness was true. And then they did that all very fast. And then, anyway, so the point is people have all these conspiracy theories. But in the end, look, do you believe quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics predicts this. Every experiment we've thrown at it has confirmed that quantum mechanics works to remarkable precision. So I don't see this as a particularly valuable line of research, but it's something people do. Students have to write PhD theses about something, right? So we get these experiments. A new one comes out every year. But I really think the case is pretty closed. We should just really think about maybe a different way of thinking about the world. But that's my opinion. Any questions about this? Yes?
Assumptions, which one do we present?
That's a personal decision.
Which one do you preserve?
I believe in realism, and therefore I am forced to abandon locality. I want to be crystal clear about something. Entanglement and this type of experiment does not enable non-local signaling. You can't signal faster than light because of this, right? So that's clear. So if you think about relativity, relativity says no signaling faster than light. And everything I've said today preserves that notion. Alice and Bob, because Alice and Bob's outcomes are random, they can't use this to make an informed decision as though they know something about what Alice was thinking. Right, so Alice isn't communicating information to Bob surreptitiously through this mechanism. Okay, so there's a really clean way to explain that, which is not occurring to me off the top of my head, but just trust me, it's true. You can think about it. You can see that there's no way to... if you think about the CHSH game, there's no way... if Bob is just looking at a random outcome based on his measurement setting, it really doesn't tell him anything about what Alice had. It's only when you go back and you look at the collected results that you realize, hey, how do we create that correlation? That's insane. Right? So that's the first point, is that this doesn't violate the signaling principle, no signaling faster than light. It just says that whatever the underlying mechanism is that explains these outcomes, that underlying mechanism has to be non-local or faster than light if you believe in realism. Which means that I can assign properties to atoms as existing. And then the other issue is, so if you just think about relativity then, relativity is saying no signaling faster than light. Relativity does not say, you know, no uncontrollable causal mechanisms can be faster than light. It just says no signaling can be faster than light. But it does violate the spirit of relativity, not the letter of relativity, of the law, so to speak. Any other questions? Yes?
I just want to double check your expression for B hat.
Okay.
Spectral decomposition.
Yeah, that's probably wrong. In fact, I think it is wrong. Is that what you want?
Yep.
Thank you. Right, because the eigenvalue is plus one and the eigenvalue here is minus one. Thank you. Okay, so let me just say something really quick. So I want to talk about a few more things. I wanted to have the chance to tell you guys a little bit about some of the research I do, in case any of you are interested in maybe doing a project with me for your project, or even considering grad school or a PhD after this program. I'm definitely always looking for enthusiastic and bright students, and I think you all fulfill those qualities. So let me just tell you a little bit about something that kind of grows out of this. I want to tell you about two things. My research program has two dimensions to it. On the one hand, I work in quantum information. And there, my main area in quantum information is understanding how to characterize actual real-world systems. So people are trying to build quantum information devices. You need incredibly precise control of the systems. And so what kind of theoretical tools can we build that helps experimentalists characterize their systems? A quantum computer is supposed to have n qubits. The Hilbert space grows exponentially with the number of qubits. It grows as 2 to the n. So you're doing these complex interactions on 2 to the n qubits. And of course, the number of ways that can fail grows exponentially with the number of qubits. So there's an incredibly large set of failure modes. And I got interested in this because I've always been interested in kind of how do you tell that something's truly quantum and not just classical? And that is tied to the question of demonstrating that you can manipulate the system in a quantum way that exceeds what you could do, say, classically. The other dimension of my research is quantum foundations, and especially quantum foundations as it relates to understanding why is it that quantum mechanics enables us to do things we can't do classically? We can write down the mathematical theory, but that doesn't really give us insight into what is going on kind of under the hood or behind the veil that's making quantum mechanics allow us to have things like superconductivity and quantum speed up, where we can solve some algorithms in an exponentially faster way than using classical computing. And so that's a big open question. So one of the things that's really interesting to me is how, we know that quantum information is more powerful than classical information, but we don't know why. And we also, people say they know why, but they don't. So you hear things like, oh, it's because of superposition, or oh, it's because of entanglement. And generally speaking, those aren't very good answers. And so I'm interested in finding good answers to that question because I've been immersed in this quantum foundations field, which has worked very hard to make clean distinctions about the quantum classical contrast. And then my hope is that, we have these very special examples of where a quantum computer is more powerful. So one of which is Shor's algorithm. And it's kind of out of the blue. Like, of all the possible problems in the world, you wouldn't a priori say, oh, Shor's algorithm. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go work on factoring large non-prime numbers and show that quantum information is giving me a special ability to solve that problem, right? So it was kind of like a stroke of brilliance that Shor recognized this capability, but we don't really have a systematic way of understanding. I think we're at the tip of the iceberg there, and it's been 20 years since Shor's algorithm, and there hasn't been that much progress on discovering other, like, really societally important applications of quantum computing other than simulating quantum systems, which is important. So we know that if you're trying to simulate, say, transport in a nanowire, and you have 400 electrons involved, you're not going to be able to classically model that Hilbert space because it's just ginormous, right? So it's just inconceivably hard to classically model a very simple important thing like quantum transport through a nanowire, which is very important for electronics and all kinds of other purposes. And so you really want to, and all across science, you want to simulate quantum systems. You want to understand the ground states of these complex many-body systems and their spectrum. And we just have no tools for solving those problems because the Hilbert space grows so fast that the classical problem becomes intractable. But we know that a quantum computer will be very good at simulating quantum systems because you get for free that exponential growth of Hilbert space and map it onto the problem directly. So you're directly mapping a quantum problem onto a quantum system, and therefore skipping this exponential overhead. So we know that quantum computers are going to be very useful for that, but we also expect they're going to be useful in other areas, and we don't have a systematic way of knowing which kinds of problems we should look for or look at to look for these advantages. So one of my research programs is to try and leverage knowledge, the 50 years of knowledge we have from quantum foundations about what is special about quantum mechanics, which includes, say, Bell's theorem, and what is not special about quantum mechanics, which includes superposition. Actually, there's a classical model for entanglement. There's a classical model for exponential growth of Hilbert space. All of these things have a classical model. So in and of themselves, each of those elements is not sufficient to explain quantum computing. It's some more complex interaction of those elements that is key. And as I mentioned at the very beginning of this class, one of the really nice results we came up with a couple years ago was demonstrating that a quantum computer cannot achieve an advantage over a classical computer unless the set of operations you're performing can violate contextuality inequality. So what's a contextuality inequality? Well, a contextuality inequality is a generalization of Bell's theorem. So it's an inequality which we prove classically can't be violated based on certain reasonable assumptions, but quantum mechanics, we see a violation. And so I'll just mention really quick to you what contextuality is, and just give you a flavor of kind of what my research program does in saying, can we take this knowledge about quantum foundations and use it to learn more about the power of quantum computing? And so, we showed that in some practical setting, and I won't go into the details, that contextuality kind of is a resource for quantum computing. Is a resource for quantum speed up. And we could show that it's necessary, but we haven't been able to show that it's sufficient. So that's an open problem. And also the result is limited to some subset of settings where you have a models for quantum computers. Was there a question?
What's like the formal definition for contextuality?
So there, it turns out contextuality is a very rich area with several definitions which aren't all equal. And so it's too technical to give you the kind of original definition by Koshin and Specker, but I'll give you a very simple illustration of contextuality due to Perez and Merman. So contextuality, and I'm going to give you kind of one incarnation of it. Is illustrated through what's called the Perez-Merman square. And the way it works is you consider you have two systems. Again, it's C2, tensor C2. So two spin half particles, and you imagine that I'm going to measure, I consider measurements of sigma x on system one and do nothing on system two, or I do nothing on system one and measure system two, or I measure at the same time system one and two. This is what's done in the Bell's theorem. You measure both systems, both spin half particles, given one preparation, you measure a Pauli operator on both systems. And then you can also imagine different sets of possible measurements you would perform on this two spin half state. And then the last one is let me make sure I got this right. I can never remember the exact pattern. First of all, I'm supposed to swap these two. So this is identity sigma y, and this is sigma y tensor identity. And then here we do sigma x tensor sigma y. So these are just different types of measurements you could perform, and I'm putting them in this organized way, and you'll see why in a minute. And then the idea of contextuality is you say, look, when I do a measurement, if I measure sigma dot A, let's call it sigma A, sigma in some direction, then I get two outcomes. So these are my pointer positions. I either get a plus one or a minus one, just like we saw in Bell's theorem. Similarly, if I measure sigma A tensor sigma B, then I get you know, a pair of outcomes, a pair of binary outcomes. And again, these, each of these binary outcomes is plus one, minus one. So let me say binary outcome. So this is, so I get one binary outcome. And here I get a pair of binary outcomes. And then the idea of contextuality is to say, let's assume that the system had the property plus or minus one. Prior to measurement, and that value was revealed through the measurement. And the measurement outcome is just revealing that prior property. So we'd like, again, it's this realism assumption. I'm assuming that the system had some value prior to measurement. And I'm assuming that when I do the measurement, I just discover what that property was, just a totally classical notion of measurement. So let's assume that quantum mechanical, that there is a reality behind quantum mechanics and that it satisfies this property. So then what you say is, well, that means that the hidden variable assignment for this property sigma A is then either minus one or plus one. So this is the pre-existing property. And we assume this one, assumption one, and then assumption two is that the observed value, which we'll call V, is just equal to lambda. So this is V of sigma A, which is the outcome you get from the Born measurement, is actually equal to the value the system had. So notice that these two assumptions, remember I gave you the Cochin-Specker model. I said you can explain everything about a single qubit with this sphere, this gyroscope on a sphere, where outcomes 0 and 1 corresponds to checking, is my system on this half or this half of the sphere? And if it's on the right half, I assign the value plus 1. And if it's on the left half, I assign the value minus 1. I found the gyroscope to be in the left half or the right half, or the bottom half or the top half. And that's where these values come from. And so the pre-existing property is the property of the gyroscope having been in that half of the hemisphere. So we can do this for D equals 2, this works. So for D equals 2, this is fine. So superposition and all that, that's completely consistent with this property. Yes?
What is D?
Pardon me?
What is D? D equals to?
H equals CD. Very good question, thank you. I have a certain standard notation that I have in my mind, and I forgot to tell you guys what that was. So D is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So if you just have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is a single two-level system or a single qubit, then you can definitely satisfy this constraint, this assumption. And the Cochin-Specker model is an explicit example of how you would do that. But for D greater than 2, so 3 or greater, these assumptions cannot be satisfied. These assumptions lead to contradiction. Lead to contradiction with quantum mechanical predictions. And that's contextuality. Contextuality is the fact that these assumptions are violated. In other words, we say that the outcome you observe depends on other information and not just the pre-existing property. So it depends on other aspects of the context and not just what you're measuring and what the pre-existing value was. And so the Pres-Merman square then, now we can prove this in the Pres-Merman square. So this is a proof. This is a proof with d equals 4. Okay. And so what we do is we say, well, look. So the value we assign to each of these observables for each of these observables, v, no matter what argument is going to be equal to minus 1 or plus 1. Because remember, we get the product of the outcomes here. So this is either minus 1 times minus 1 or plus 1 times plus 1, or we're looking at the product, the correlation. OK, and then we observe that for every row, then we assume that for commuting observables, let me write it over here. Okay, so the Pres-Merman proof you assume that for commuting observables, you have A and B are two commuting observables, then you assume that V of A times B is equal to V of B times A is equal to V of B times V of A. Okay, so we're assuming that I can measure A and B in any order because they commute. I'm assuming that my measurement of A yields an outcome, which was a prior property of A. And I assume my measurement of B yields an outcome, which was a prior property of the observable B, and that I can change the order of these, and that the pre-existing value of B and the pre-existing value of A commute. So this is the key mathematical assumption. And then you realize that in each row, sigma x and sigma x and sigma, these all commute. But you remark that for each row, we have that a result in the form of sigma tensor identity times identity tensor sigma. So these are all commuting operators times sigma tensor sigma is equal to the identity operator. Because sigma x squared is equal to identity. So you have sigma x times sigma x, which is identity, and you have sigma x times sigma x, which is identity. So the whole thing multiplies to identity, and identity only has one eigenvalue, which is plus 1. So we don't know if we get plus, I mean, you could have minus 1 minus 1 times plus 1, or you could have plus 1 minus 1 minus 1. You need some combination of these plus and minuses that multiply to plus 1. So these have to multiply to plus 1. And that's true for this row. And it's also true for this row, because sigma x times sigma z gives sigma y. And sigma x times sigma y gives sigma z. And sigma z squared is identity. And sigma y times sigma x gives minus I sigma z. And sigma z times sigma z is identity. And you can multiply all the minus i's together, and you get plus one. And similarly, for each column, these multiply to plus one, and this multiplies to plus one, except the third column multiplies to minus one, because this operator times this operator gives minus identity, which only has one eigenvalue, which is minus one. So we assume that these have to multiply together. So we have to get some combination. We have to get at least one or three minuses, but not two minuses, in these measurements so that the product is minus one. These are commute. These are all. Each column has commuting operators. But now you realize that's a contradiction. There's no set of prior values. There's no way you can assign, if I multiply all the rows together, I have to get plus one. But if I multiply all the columns together, I have to get minus one. And that's impossible. So that's the contradiction. So multiplying rows together. Gives plus one, and multiplying these for the columns gives minus one, and that's a contradiction. So there's no assignment of these which is consistent with the set of possible outcomes you could get. So this is very puzzling. In a sense, Bell's theorem is a special case of this. So Bell's theorem is a kind of contextuality. In Bell's theorem, we have Alice and Bob doing their two measurements, A0, A1, and B0, B1. And we assume that the outcome Bob gets doesn't depend on, I mean, because they're space-like separated, they commute, right? So we're saying the outcome Bob gets can't depend on what Alice measures. It can't depend on that context. It can only depend on the locally available information. And so Bell's theorem is a kind of contextuality, or not, is a, Bell's inequality is a assumption of non-contextuality, which is justified by special relativity. Contextuality is the more general scenario where we know that the probability of getting plus or minus one for this operator or this operator or this operator doesn't depend. If I measure this guy, if this is what I measure on my system, the Born rule probabilities for what I get, no matter what the state is, doesn't matter if I measure it with this commuting set or with this commuting set. So once I measure this, I can measure other simultaneously commuting operators. So I can measure it with this set or this set, but these guys don't commute. So I can either do this measurement or this measurement, but I can't do both. So the probability of what I get here, the quantum mechanical prediction, which is a probability, not an outcome, doesn't depend on which context I use. But the pre-existing value, the value I get from the measurement can't just be the pre-existing value. The value I get depends not just on the pre-existing value for this, but how I do the measurement. Am I doing it in a context that allows me to measure this set? Or am I doing it in a context that allows me to do this set? So contextuality is saying, even though the quantum mechanical predictions don't care how I'm going to do it, I can predict this without you telling me if you're doing it this way or this way. If I want to think about the outcome has to depend on how you're going to do it. And when it's Alice and Bob, well, the outcome shouldn't depend on whether Alice measures A0 or Alice measures A1. Because she's space-like separated. But in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, relativity is kind of irrelevant. So here we're just showing that when the quantum mechanical prediction says something doesn't matter, it actually does matter from the point of view of underlying realism. So you can just discard this as a curiosity, or you can see that as an opportunity to say, look, this is showing there's something very special going on in quantum mechanics when you have this kind of structure. So if I consider this set of observables, I can create the contradiction. If I have a subset of these observables, I can't create the contradiction. So what we did is we said, well, let's look at models for quantum computing based on these sophisticated methods for getting efficient quantum computing. And we showed that those methods can be classically simulated unless they include a set of operations which leads to a contextuality contradiction. So that was the result. And so I think that this is a very, I think we're at the tip of the iceberg here in terms of understanding more about quantum mechanics from these old results and how that leads to characterizing the power and the resources available in quantum computing. I guess I've run out of time, so I won't tell you more about these characterization methods I've developed. It's much more practically oriented, and I'd be happy to talk about that after class if anyone's interested. Is that a question? Are there any questions about this? I mean, this is hard to digest on a first viewing, so it took me 10 years to understand this. Yeah.
I have a question with the quotient Sparrow model. You said that it recreated all the things from a qubit, but say if you measured sigma x, then sigma y, then sigma x, and two measurements for sigma x were different, can you model that with the quotient
spectrum? Yeah, so it turns out the quotient spectrum model can't describe sequential measurements, but a guy named Montina, who worked here as a postdoc, built a generalization of the quotient spectrum model, which does describe sequential measurements classically in an epistemic theory. So it wasn't, it can be done, but it requires an additional structure. I'd encourage you to look that up because he's actually a alumnus of Perimeter Institute. Other questions? Yeah? No? Okay then. Well, I hope I've given you a lot to think about, and thank you for all the great questions this term.